Accession number 4662, room number 1.
Anderson, Reel 1. Could you tell me, please, to start with, Mr. Anderson, how you came to join the RAF?
Well, I came from a service background. Both my grandfathers were in the army. My father served quite a long time in the army, and my thoughts were always with the services. And originally, I became interested in flying at a very young age in Preston, where my father was serving at that particular time. And I remember as a very small boy, between 3 and 4 years old, sitting on the kitchen floor and hearing my parents talking about a man who had arrived there and actually flying in the air. And they were talking in terms of great awe and amazement. The man could get up in the air and fly. And that afternoon, family decided to take myself and my other brothers out to the park where this man was flying from. And I always remember going out there as a small child, and unfortunately it began to rain and this aeroplane was whipped along and put underneath trees. My father lifted me up on his shoulders, and there I saw a white aeroplane, which to me now, or later in years, I recognise as a Blériot-type aeroplane. And the man who's actually flying it was a name of Hamel, Gustav Hamel. This must have been about 1911 or 1912, when he visited England and demonstrated this aeroplane and offered, I think, postal services to between Windsor and somewhere else. I can't quite remember the details now. But that was my very first experience of flying. That stood out in my memory for some reason. I don't know why. And during my boyhood, I became interested in flying, airmen. And in particular, during the Daily Mirror offer of £10,000 for the first pilot to fly the Atlantic. And this particular time I was at Margate. My father was serving in Canterbury, still in the army, and I must have been about 10 at that particular time. And I used to read these everyday accounts of these men refueling from Newfoundland and attempts for takeoff. And I remember in particular Harry Hawker taking off and ditching in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, and no one heard of him for some time. And also eventually Alcock and Brown achieved the flying of the Atlantic. This excited me considerably, and I came tremendously interested in flying and made many models, flying models and static models. And eventually from Margate, from that time, my father was posted to Egypt. I went to Egypt. And of course, always associated with the army, with the services, either living in barracks or quarters associated with barracks. And I finished my education in Alexandria at an American commercial school. My father had thought of having a better life as a civilian rather than in the army, because he was rather disappointed in the army eventually, because he was not commissioned. He only achieved first class warrant rank, and he became too old, or they didn't go into his branch when they selected the commissions when he was due for one. And he thought army life was a bit difficult and not very fruitful. In any case, I finished my schooling out there, or rather my father was sent back to England. By this time I was 17. And of course, coming back to England in the mid-20s, the height of the Depression, I couldn't get a job in spite of my qualifications as a bookkeeper, accountant, shorthand typist, commercial law, commercial geography. Didn't mean a thing when I got to England in 1926. I just couldn't get a job. And my brother and I sort of talked together a lot, and he went off one weekend and joined the Royal Navy. And then I considered I'd join the services myself. And doing so, always at the back of my mind was the Royal Air Force, though I couldn't see any particular career there. And I got all the pamphlets, leaflets and such like from all the Army, Navy and Air Force. One time I thought of joining as a stoker in the Royal Navy, because I could see there was a career there if one passed certain examinations, your educational qualifications was sufficient, one could become an engine room artificer. But my brother wrote back to me, as I said, in the mid-20s, and said a lot of stokers in the Royal Navy were miners, especially Newcastle miners, who couldn't get work, were joining, and they were a very rough crowd. You'd speak entirely different language than they speak, and you'd be an outcast and probably get into trouble, or they'd just pick on me. And he advised me not to join as a stoker. So I considered the Army and Air Force in particular. So I wrote to the Air Force with my background of commercial education. I noted that if you joined the Air Force in the ranks, you could become selected there when you were a qualified tradesman for pilot training. And I thought, well, this is exciting. And so I thought of this possibility. With this in mind, and also I fully expected I would join the service some way or the other. So anyway, I applied to join as a clerk in the Royal Air Force, and they turned me down in this respect because I had no practical experience in spite of qualifications.
As a clerk?
As a clerk. So, but they did say they had some vacancies for semi-skilled wireless operators, a thing of which I had no knowledge at all. Like my electrical knowledge only consisted of connecting up an electric house bell. That's all the thing, anything I'd done in the electrical line at all. Anyway, I applied to join as a semi-skilled wireless operator, and I eventually went to Quieter House in Whitehall, where I sat for an examination, entry examination. And I went in for the written paper and asked what was my civilian occupation. Well, I said a clerk. And they gave me a paper consisting of percentages, averages, and discounts, which was so utterly easy to me at that time. I was very fortunate to be able to get such an easy paper, which I finished quite easily, and had an English paper, and eventually an interview, and a medical examination. And from there, I was sent to West Drayton. There were two sign on for whatever period of service one wished to serve, and also to take the oath of allegiance. Anyway, when they asked me how long I wanted to serve for, it was a 12-year service complete, but you do it in steps, either 6 years actual service, 6 on reserve, 7 service, 5 on reserve, etc. So what's the longest period I can serve for? So they said, well, 9 years longest and 3 on reserve, so I'll sign on for 9. I was determined to make a career of the Air Force. I could see no other possibility but to stay in it. And the trade they offered me was aircraft hand under training wireless operator. So my training as a wireless operator was confirmed. So from at RAF West Drayton, I took the oath and signed for service, and had my first meal there in the RAF. They were just rebuilding it or altering it slightly, and the dining room consisted of 4 walls about head high, a muddy floor with a trestle table and forms with Hessian as a roof, and it was raining, which is dripping through onto our cold mutton stew. That was my introduction to the RAF, my very first meal. Anyway, I thought, well, this is only temporary, and about only one day there, and from there the party of new recruits sent to the RAF depot at Uxbridge.
This was in March 1927.
March 1927, and the official date was the 21st of March 1927. So I arrived at the RAF depot. We put into a barrack block and began kitting up, going down the stores for uniform, etc., plates, knife, fork and spoon, all the rest of the normal kit one has, and from there we had lectures for the first few days, obviously a haircut, short back and sides, and told to get a bath, clean up, and send away all your civilian clothes. Weren't allowed to retain any article of civilian clothing. Everything had to go and be put in a parcel, which was given over to the stores, who sent it to our homes. So we just in our uniform. For the first time in my life, I put on a flannel shirt next to my skin, which seemed to irritate very badly, but amazing how one got used to it in next to no time. And wearing ammunition boots, but they became comfortable after they'd been broken in, so it wasn't so very uncomfortable after all. And from there we started our foot training. We did drill of a morning for the first hour or so. We were just doing foot drill, marching up and down, learning to form fours as we did in those days, and about turns, right turns, and developed to salute in the front and saluting on the march. And also from there, the first hour or so of foot drill, we had dashed to our barrack block, where we changed into a PT kit and doubled down to the gymnasium, where we did the rest of the morning physical training, which is continuous. And after a few days, everything, every muscle and bone in my body ached. but that passed off in time, and one began to enjoy the mere fact of physical exercise and the training on the square. From foot drill, we went to stick drill. In those days, we carried short Malacca canes with sort of chromium tops, ready to add to smartness and something to do with your hands when you're walking out, which became quite a habit to carry these small canes. And we'd learnt cane drill, how to use it, walk with a cane, march with a cane, salute with a cane. It was all very interesting, and one became very smart in a very short time. And then, of course, onto rifle drill. Then halfway through the training, they selected men for physical training display for the Royal Tournament at Olympia. And I was one of the selected for the Royal Tournament, and also I was selected being tall, about 6'2", I think, in those days. I was selected for the Guard of Honour, if should be required, at Olympia for any royalty being there. So, which eventually turned out, when I did go to the Royal Tournament, King George V was there on one of the occasions, and we turned out with the Royal Naval Guard, Guard of Honour on the right, the Guards in the centre, and the Air Force on the left. And we each in turn presented arms. I always remember, of course, being the tallest man, the squad had been on the right-hand side, I was next to the Guards, and a terrific crash went up from them. A cloud of Blanco came from their slings. and we presented arms in our turn. As our instructor said, we are just as good as the Guards, show them what we can do. Always like that, we've always been egged on. You can do as good as the Guards, you're just as good as the Guards. I always remember my instructor, he was doing right-hand guide. He used to say on the square when drilling, hit those rifles, I want to see blood. I want to see blood, hit them. I know we hit them as hard as we could, our hands just get sore, but still we had to hit them hard. And much to my amusement, out of the corner of my eye, we also had white Blanco slings at that time for any ceremonial parades, and I could see a trickle of blood going down his white sling. It hit his rifle, must have caught it on the top swivel of the sling, I should imagine. Anyway, that hardly amused me, in spite of King George V inspecting us. Only by the way, it was great fun doing the training and the actual exhibition at tournament. We used to march up there every day from Uxbridge, and I think we got half a crown a day for it out of that, which we had to pay sixpence to have our shorts and vests laundered every day. So actually we got 2 shillings a day, which was quite a fortune on top of our pay. And of course we had extra expenses of a little bit of food or coffees or mostly ice cream up there. So, which we wouldn't normally buy at a training at a depot. Anyway, the depot training went on for approximately to about mid-July, as far as I can remember, 1927, from March to mid-July. And I can say, I enjoyed it. We were chased all the time, always on the move, never had much peace. Lights out at, I think it was 10:15. You'd then show a glimmer after nights out in the valley at 6 o'clock. You had to be up quickly, and also we had to go for a run first thing in the morning for breakfast, out into PT kit. It's about 6:30 or a valley, whatever the time was, and for a run round the square a few times, and then back to change for breakfast, then out on the parade ground ready for parade. And also we did a mass parade of King George V's birthday. It was quite a term, biggest parade I think I've ever been on. with so many people on parade with fixed bayonets and marching, march past, and the advance and review order was very majestic, I think, and I enjoyed drill somehow because I was fit as a schoolboy in Egypt. I did a lot of swimming. I used to go to school early morning, and all the afternoons would be free, so I had plenty of time to go swimming. We lived near the coast and make surfing, surf swimming, and saw surf boating and playing polo. I was extremely fit, in spite of my age of just approaching 19 by this time. And so all these exercises didn't affect me at all. I mean, a bit stiff at first with the drill and the PT, but I always enjoyed physical exertion. And also I volunteered for the trainees' tug-of-war team. I got introduced to laying on a rope, putting up a heavy weight on a very large tripod. But it never came to anything. We never pulled against anybody. We just did a lot of extra training in our spare time. But then again, I didn't mind that. Then training completed. The Royal Tournament finished, and training completed. We considered fit for our posting to our units, where the tradesmen were going, clerks to so and such a place. I think they went to Ruislip for their training. And wireless operators were sent to the electrical and wireless school at Flowerdown. Here we put in bungalows, we call them then, low buildings. I think they were built in the First World War. Quite cozy if one could get cold during the winter. But such a short supply, and last about a couple of nights, our ration. But the summer was fairly pleasant, and the lectures were something entirely new to me, because luckily we started from basic electricity, and the lecturers mostly were ex-naval wireless people.
They were in fact civilians at this
They
time.
Were civilians, yes. All the instructional staff were civilians. The odd one or two flight sergeants, but I don't think they sort of supervised rather than instructed. But in the main section, it was all civilians, ex-service people, as I said. Also, they trained boy wireless operator mechanics. They had the prestige of being a wireless operator mechanic. The course was a bit longer, or the boys' training would be a bit longer. And also some of the men who were lucky to either remuster or be enlisted as mechanics, they did workshop practice, turning and building of sets, and workshop practice, a little bit of metal bashing, as we called it, metal work. And their course would be a bit longer than just playing wireless operator. Anyway, it was quite discipline was very strong. There was no hanky-panky at all. We kept moving the whole time, all throughout the day, down to lectures. And our evenings were free. We had no restrictions, because pay was very low in those days. I think basically it was 2 shillings a day, but we couldn't get our full pay during the first year, because we had to build up a reserve for if we had to buy a uniform. Our first issue was free, but after that you had to buy it. And rather than sort of stop your pay when you bought a new uniform, one was obliged to build up an account, so some of much pay was stopped. And also they stopped a certain amount for barrack damages. And also at pay parade, there was always a table there by the door as you went out collecting sports money, or as the sports officer, an NCO standing by him collecting. This was supposed to be voluntary contribution, I think it was threepence or some small sum like that, but from a few hundred men, it mounted up to supply sports gear. But it was supposed to be voluntary, but you had to be very strong will to go by without paying. Anyway, a number of chaps in our hut, including myself, decided one day not to pay, that we'd have our right and voluntary wouldn't pay. So we all, as we went past, said we don't wish to pay this voluntary subscription. So that's all right, you needn't pay. But they took our name and number, a whole list of us. And Wednesday afternoons normally devoted to sport. People were playing in sports, went out in the sports field or did what they liked. Went running, training, boxing in the gym. and such like, but people who had nothing to do stayed in the billets, in the bungalows, excuse the term billets, but we call them billets, to study if they were so inclined, or read, or just relaxed, or just had a sleep. I know the first Wednesday after pay parade, in came a certain NCO and said, call out all our names who have been put down on the non-payment of sports. Said, oh, you're not interested in sports, are you? Well, you can go on fatigues. We ground us all up, we marched to the cookhouse, and we sat down peeling spuds for the rest of the afternoon, or any other fatigue they could think of. So we decided it's better to pay our troops a week after that rather than go on fatigues on Wednesday afternoon. So the sports fund prospered that way. So anyway, the training went on. While I was under training as a wireless operator, I volunteered to go in for bayonet fencing. I asked the volunteers for bayonet fencing, thing I'd never seen before, but I thought it'd be interesting. And the bayonet fencing team, as we were called, went to the gym Wednesday afternoons. Now I had a sport for Wednesday afternoons, and also evenings, any spare time. We used to be rounded up by a very keen flight sergeant, gymnasium instructor, and he taught us bayonet fencing. And strange to say, I achieved quite some success in this pastime. I was tall, had long reach, and coordination was good, reaction was good, and I became probably their best bayonet fencer. And from here, we worked as a team always. I never took part in any individual contests, but we had fun. And also we took part in the 1928 Royal Tournament Championships against the Army and Air Force. Our first contest was against the Royal Marines, but unfortunately we just lost by one point, I think. It's a very narrow margin, but if we had just one more good man in the team, we would have beaten the Royal Marines at their own game very nearly. That was a bit of a disappointment. We lost we didn't get the silver medal for it, but it was an interesting trip. And also we stood to have, also we fought other RAF teams for the RAF championships, our team won the inland area, it was called in those days, all the training stations inland area. We won the inland area championship. I thought it was quite pleasing, for which I got a little medal which I have to these days, suitably engraved. So that also kept me quite fit. And also on Saturday mornings I used to go running as training, strengthen the legs. The training went on and on. Now I got quite interested in this electrical and wireless business, besides learning all the theory of telegraphy, telephony, and all the theory of either transmission of waves. We also had to learn the circuit of every set we used. It was not quite an undertaking, considering only a few wireless sets were used in those days. We knew the circuit and could explain the theory of the circuit, how it worked, and faults and failures. And we had practice sort of huts stationed round about the area of the camp, used a transmitting receiving station where he did the duty as sort of a wireless operator up there transmitting in Morse code. Most communications was done in those days by Morse code, either between stations. We had become quite proficient in Morse code. There's only one speed at passing out, and that was a maximum speed. You had to achieve the maximum speed of 25 words per minute in Morse code to qualify as a wireless operator. If you couldn't do that, you weren't considered a wireless operator. And telephony, it didn't harp much on telephony because it wasn't used ground to ground or such like. It was only used on air, which I found out eventually. So not much attention was paid to telephony, but you had to be able to draw the circuit of the transmitter and receiver, know the faults, and the generators used. So it's quite an interesting and full training, which took from about July 27 when I went there to about September the following year, so just over a year's training of continuous lectures and drill. We did a certain amount of drill and inspections. So one was quite a good tradesman. I passed out in the lowest grade. I didn't achieve any more than a second-class aircraftman as a wireless operator. If you were very good, you probably got a first class, but very few ever achieved leading aircraftsmen. That's practically impossible. But the I don't think there's a policy not to grant leading aircraftsmen from a school. So you've either passed out AC1, it was called, or AC2, wireless operator. I became AC2. And from there, I was posted to the Fleet Air Arm station at Gosport. Those days, the Fleet Air Arm was rather a mixture of RAF and naval people. Not the pilots were naval, but most of the men, mechanics and such like, were RAF then. They had to go to sea in the aircraft carriers, and so did RAF pilots. And I know in my where I lived in the old fort at Fort Grange, it's an old Napoleon, built in Napoleon's days, the impending war for Napoleon. And the very old building, the bedroom or our room was underground. It was built into a great big bank of earth. It only had windows one end, and of course we had a sort of naval routine there. It was a sort of a naval ship within a RAF station, and we had to wet scrub our floors the naval fashion every Friday night for inspection Saturday morning. I know one day. The inspecting officer came round and asked our orderly standing by, and he said, "How long do these floors take to dry? They're still wet after a Friday night wash down." And he said, "Oh, we'll probably still be wet by next Friday." So they'd be lucky it'll dry by Wednesday. Since we'd not looked at this man, didn't know what to do about whether he's being funny, insolent, or what. Anyway, let the matter rest. But after that, I noticed that they've cancelled the order for wet scrubbing. It was very unhealthy on underground at a wet scrum floor that never dried out, really dried out. And so it must have been a sympathetic orderly officer, probably an RAF man, not a naval orderly officer that day. So that was just a little, by the way, incident. I worked there in the main wireless cabin. That was communications, part of the Air Ministry intercommunication system. Every station communicated with the Air Force by Morse code. We ran a watch system, went on early morning, more or less, at not quite first light, but quite early, and called up Air Ministry, asked for any messages, it'd be yes or no, or stand by for a message, you take it down, and then probably somebody would leave you for breakfast, next watch would come on, and so on. That was quite interesting, and we passed all the important letters that or. Any important messages had to be sent by air rather than go by mail, and kept one fairly busy, and also one booked out aircraft to flying to another station. There's always a system in the RAF to let the aircraft, when they go to another station, their expected time of arrival and expected time of departure, etc. So there's a general communication going on all day, and it's quite an interesting job. And night time, we went on a night. It went fairly late at night. I don't quite remember what time now, but then it was quite slack at night. We used to, I know, all things should have happened then, unofficial talking to each other, sort of. Whilst operators developed a language of their own, they talked to each other by symbols, by exclamations, and such like. Or even I heard two blokes playing chess. They would give just again sending out the movements in Morse code. And that cake knights four to so and so, bishops two or something like that, whatever the movements are in chess. It doesn't take much time, just a quick flash over on the key, and quite suitable for Morse code. So I thought, well, that's something. From there, I hadn't been there very long. I went there in about September, and round about January the following year, I received no posting for overseas service. Oh, before I would leave this Fleet Air Arm station, we serviced the aircraft there on the station, and flew them out the aircraft when they were going to sea. They didn't stay in harbour in Portsmouth, because Gosport was near Portsmouth, of course. The aircraft were flown to land base for overhaul, anything like that, while the ship was in harbour or at anchor. And of course, pilots had leave or went back to the ship, as the case may be. And also, living in our billet was a corporal who was a wireless operator on the tug, another airman who went to sea. He used to hate his job, but there was one of those things he had to do. His job was to be on this tug that towed a frame where aircraft made a dummy run for practicing approaches onto an aircraft carrier flying on the rear of it, and he just kept in communication with base and knew when the next aircraft was coming. The aircraft didn't communicate with him, it was just with the land base, and in case of accidents, of course, he could immediately phone for help if necessary or go to the rescue himself. But he didn't like being on the small tug in the small wireless cabin. Those sort of jobs wireless operators in the Air Force got at times. Anyway, from there...
If I could interrupt here for a minute, had you done any flying yourself? Had you been airborne at all when you were
the
first 2 years?
Yes, that's
England?
A point I left out. Yes, while under training at Flower Down, we had to have air experience, which was very short, and that was at Worthy Down, near the flying station where they had night bombers, but they did have a small detachment in a canvas hangar of Bristol fighters. And we went across there towards the end of our training. I remember it was about August, about a month or so or before I finished the course. Had to go across there and do our flying experience. We were told to tune in a certain wavelength and call up the station, get an answer. They give you a dummy message which you have to reply to, or you have to send one yourself. And so...